Here we go again, it's the game we love.
Play game.
Keep our minds on the game.
You are listening to KBOO Community Radio, and this is Winner's Bias, America's first, best, and only live board game radio show.
Until proven otherwise.
A show about board games and doing math for fun. I'm one of your hosts, Nate, and with me is my buddy, James. How are you doing?
I'm here, and I'm doing good.
Excellent. As a reminder, you can almost comment. Sorry, forgetting to click buttons. Now you can. You can comment on our show live using the OLARC messaging system on KBOO.fm. Just click on the Chat With Us button in the lower right corner of the window. We're excited to welcome Dana and Law to the show. They are the architects of the House D&D campaign at TPK Brewing here in Portland. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Good morning indeed.
So I guess just for a little background before we start diving into what you do, how did you get into role-playing games? And Dana, we'll start with you.
What a question. Well, growing up, my family had a games closet with a shelf that went all the way from the floor to the ceiling. And about the age of 9 or 10, my brother and I took to climbing it and looking for the goodies at the top that we hadn't seen before. And tucked away on the highest shelf of that closet, we found an old Tom Moldvay edition basic D&D set from the 70s. And we taught ourselves to play it, and then taught other people how to play it.
Excellent. Was there any, like, I don't know what era, what time frame was this? Like, what era was this?
For me, this was the mid-90s, 93, okay. 94.
Okay, excellent. Law, how about you?
I have my own kind of scarlet letter to bear when it comes to my shame of joining. I did start very early at 9, and I know I was doing it wrong. Like, I can remember me and my friends not knowing the rules and just kind of goofing around. But there was a board game in the post-HeroScape kind of era called Dragon Strike that was made by Hasbro. And it came with a VHS tape that showed you how to play the game, and it had the worst quality, like, live video of people in the fantasy world doing fantasy things with a game master that was like a turtleneck and a floating head. And that was my hook, line, and sinker. So if you ever have the YouTube Dragon Strike VHS, it is a phenomenally bad and wonderful video, and that was my awakening.
I remember the ads for that.
Yeah.
That's how you get everyone into playing D&D. Just watch this one tape, and you'll love it.
It also had a lot of great miniatures, which is why that's one of the things I'm, like, most obsessed with, is, like, the boards and the assets.
Can you two remember the first character you made, and, like, if there's anything special about them?
Just name and class build.
What was it?
Elven fighter mage named Orcadian Valis.
Oh, gosh. Okay, so in basic Dungeons & Dragons,
yeah,
famously, you rolled your ability scores straight down. You didn't get to choose what was high or what was low, and you could remove 1 point or 2 points from one ability score to add 1 point to another. I rolled a natural 18 intelligence.
Ooh.
So naturally, I reduced that to 12 to raise my 7 strength to 10 so I could be a fighter. His name was Dragoon Kane, after the Final Fantasy IV character.
That's great. And so you dabbled in... How did you find your gaming groups to sort of sustain playing? And I know you said, Dana, that you and your sibling had played together, but, like, how did you branch out beyond that?
Right. It started off as our immediate friends. There's a term in the tabletop gaming community that is forever game master, forever dungeon master. That was very much me growing up, so I very often brought the game to other people and invited them to play and taught them how to play. So I, for the most part, formed my own gaming groups, but around middle school, I started meeting other people that also played. And I guess, like an amoeba, we just kind of came together.
Yeah, I came from a family that had zero gaming background. There was no board games in my house. I didn't have, like, one of those mothers or fathers who had been playing in the 70s already. So it was really just stumbling upon it with a friend who had a book, and then us trying to find others to play with, and then just lifelong friends all kind of get soaked into the hobby. Organically, fairly, because they, too, would have just been into it. But just lifetime players. I was also the forever GM.
How would you persuade them to try it for the first time? Because I feel like that's a difficult thing, especially with now, with people knowing kind of what D&D is and it's that nerd thing. How do you persuade them to come into that game and enjoy it?
I mean, as an adult, I could see that. But if you're, like, below the age of 13, I feel like you're up for anything, as long as it's kind of cool sounding.
Right. And now I think there's a bigger cultural consciousness of, at least, that Dungeons & Dragons exists and sort of what it is. And it's much easier to get over that first step. Back then, I will admit, we were far less role-playing and much more wargaming. It's very easy to say, let's play this cool fantasy game.
Yeah. That was also an era where, like, you genuinely would get shamed for being one of the game players, and now it's just so normal and sought after. It's a big flip-flop of what's cool and what's not.
It's a little bit of a tangent, but growing up, it was kind of funny to think back because there was also kind of a weird hierarchy amongst the role players at schools. Mm-hmm. Dungeons and Dragons was respectable compared to the vampire players.
Yeah, it's true. It's even like early wargaming when they were like, we're doing reenactments of like Civil War era things and you're playing with dwarves and ents, you nerds.
That's amazing.
Speaking of like other RPGs, so obviously D&D is like the top one, the most well known. Is there any other RPGs that you would like recommend to maybe get people started or bring people in as well?
Well, what's interesting, that is actually a pretty recent phenomenon. It's only within the last 10 years or so that Dungeons & Dragons has really captured the percentage of the kind of the player base that it has in the industry. It was always a big one. It was always the most recognized, but kind of in the 80s, early 90s, in the broader community, it was often seen more as a kids' role-playing game compared to more mature games like Call of Cthulhu.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of great games to play now, and like, while D&D very much, the books are the rules. Like, it's not necessarily telling you how to tell the story. There's a lot of them where the mechanics are actually how to tell the story. Like, Powered by the Apocalypse is one of the ones we get a lot at TPK. And just narrative games like that where the rules are very light. The character sheet's like three or four things, and you're just sharing a story together. And at the end of the game, it's just kind of a narrative revelation, not like 10 plus 15 equals whatever. No.
Yeah. Right. In the grand scheme of things, Dungeons & Dragons is still very, very tied to its wargaming roots. And I think there are a great number of games that I would recommend people play just to understand better what a role-playing is and can be. But you said favorite.
Yeah, well, yeah.
So I think I will take this moment to say that my favorite modern RPG designer is probably a writer-designer named Jay Dragon. They famously do games like Wanderhome, Sleepaway Camp. And so if I'm going to champion one today, I'm going to have to say Yazeba's Bed and Breakfast. It's not one that I think I initially would have tried if I didn't have a group of people that invited me to play it. And that's because I very much like making my own character, and it's a game where you play with a cast of pre-written characters, but it's very Saturday morning cartoon, a little sitcom-y. Each one-shot in the book is a different episode with its own central problem and often its own little mini-game mechanics, and it's so fun.
Sounds very charming.
I'm going to blow the dust off a weird one and say that the one like system that was not D&D that hit me the hardest and stuck in my brain was called Dogs in the Vineyard. And it's hard to find. It's like a little paperback mini booklet. It's like $100 on eBay. But the main theme is that you're kind of these like this order of clerics in this weird like non-historical Western setting. But the dice mechanics are like you have pools of dice and you like ante against each other. So in that, you almost get like a tangible feeling of that kind of Western poker game. But it's also like everything's narrative. So like there's a difference between a knife and a really big knife. And it's just a beautiful, like very dark and mystical setting.
Right. And it falls very close to a lot of the themes that I know you like, which are, for example, it is very tied to the idea that you're this fairly religious type of character and that your faith can even shield you from bullets and things like that if you believe hard enough.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you for that. So let's get into a little bit about TPK Brewing and what you're trying to create there. Like, what is it? What does TPK stand for? What are you trying to build?
Yeah, I mean, it's just your normal, friendly neighborhood role-playing game-based brew pub.
Just one of those.
Every neighborhood has them.
But yeah, I would say those are two very ingrained sides of our business. We are a brewery. We brew all of our own beer. There's food and drinks. We also have a role-playing game side. We have game masters on staff. That is their full-time job, and people can book games with them online. They have reoccurring campaigns. Compared to something like, you know, like a game store that is store first and venue second, we're really more venue first and game store second. We are technically a game store. But we're a place, first and foremost, where people can hang out, play games, have good brews, and really hang out with each other.
The super, like, spark notes of the origin is to speak for the other two owners of the business, who is just the brewmaster, makes all the beer. She's incredible, wins a bunch of awards. And that's why the beer itself is just so delicious. And then our CEO, Elliot. And the super condensed version is that they would, you know, good friends, make beer, play D&D, want to bring the beer into the D&D game and connect those themes. And that slowly snowballed into what is now the all the beers being themed after characters and settings in the fantasy world that we run.
Right. It was a particular point in time. They've known each other for a lot longer than we've been involved. They're old friends. And around that time, they were playing Dungeons & Dragons with each other on a weekly basis, and they both started getting into home brewing at around the same time, and Jess started making beers that tied into their game, named after places, characters, villains. Famously, our award-winning Ashbringer Stout, made with cinnamon sticks and Mexican chocolate, was originally named after one of the villains in their campaign. That was sort of this old witchy hag type character.
And what does TPK stand for those who might not be in the role-playing world?
Well, there's a tragedy that happens sometimes at the game where the game master and the enemies that they present manage to defeat the entire party, you know, killing everyone, or if you're in a more kind of soft tone game, reducing everyone to kind of an unconsciousness, but that's a total party kill.
I was telling my wife how we're going to interview you, and she asked what TPK stands for, and I told her, and she goes, "Why would you ever do that?" I don't know. I don't know why you would kill the whole party.
Right. It's always at the whim of the dice. I don't think it's ever intentional. And in an online RPG, it might be called a party wipe. But yeah, total party kill.
I mean, it's like you want to play a video game, but you don't want to just beat it on your first try. You want some challenges. And some groups are like, maybe go easy on us. And other ones are like, take the gloves off. Give us everything you got. We want a challenge.
Yeah, and a little bit behind the scenes, we thought about a lot of different names. We wanted to make it clear what we were, which is a brewery. And we wanted it to be a soft nod that anyone in the gaming community would recognize as a gaming term and know that gaming happens there, but without making it confusing what we were.
Making it too on the nose.
Right.
So with the brewery and it being like a game store, there wasn't one that came first. It kind of came together at the same time. It wasn't like, we're going to make a game store, and we might as well do brewery with it.
Right, so it was the crossroads, the intersection of these brews themed with their game that they drank while playing, that really conceived the idea of this brewery where that's what happens. People hang out, they play games, and everything ties into that. And that came decades before it became a business.
Yeah, it could still exist as just a cool place to hang out and drink beer and have good food. Shout out to Invita, who does our kitchen stuff. I don't know that it could exist as just a place to play games. They kind of have to be together. You need both working together, I think.
I'm going to do a quick reset before we dive back in. You are listening to 90.7 KBOO Portland. If you're just tuning in, I'm Nate, here with James, and this is Winner's Bias, a show about the board gaming hobby. We're talking to Dana and Law from TPK Brewing. So your community of role players, people coming to you to play what you are creating, has grown a lot. Like, how did you build that community?
Well, you're referring to the main one is going to be our in-house campaign.
Yes,
which
yes,
is called the Layfarer's Chronicle. It's a setting that Dana wrote, so I'll let Dana talk about that. And then I'll talk about kind of what it meant to the people who joined it early on.
Right. There's a couple of questions there. But what you're referring to is our in-house campaign. Currently, we have around 160 players. Thankfully, it started out as the much more meager 60-player size, which is weird to think about now. But yes, all of them are divided up into their own teams, their own parties. They play on their own days and times, but they all play in the shared world. They all impact things that others experience. Storylines run 3 months at a time every quarter. And so events happen that affect all of the players, and then it always culminates in a big event that brings all of them together. And so they're not just interacting with their own teammates, but also in these finales, as well as just side questing, which is very popular to just pick up one-shot games in the setting outside of the main campaign. They get to play with all these other players at large. They're all part of the same almost Adventurers Guild, and so it's very interesting to just see how that evolved, because it's not all things we could have planned for.
Yeah, and a lot of the job obviously involves, you know, coordinating the game times and then running the games with our team of, like, really great professional game masters. Like, we've got to vet them all. Some of them we've known for a while, and others we've never met before we interviewed them. They're all great. I would play happily at any of their games. But there's a lot more, like, I was surprised to learn that there's a lot more writing. Like, most of my job is writing, and I still run games all the time, because we're all working together to create a story that is the same for everyone. They each experience it in their own way, because they each have their own game master. But the content, it needs to be consistent. They need to know, like, this thing that they're experiencing could happen to other groups unless they made a different choice. So we're all sharing documents constantly. We're all coming together after sessions and touching base, say, hey, this group did this. This worked really well. Let's keep this in mind for things like content warnings or challenge ratings. And it's just a huge collaborative thing. Like, our Google Drive is just this bloated beast of things that we're all writing together and editing together.
When you created the campaign, did you ever think in your wildest dreams it could fill up 160 characters in there?
No. I think at the outset, we started off with like 50, 60 people, like I said. And we imagined back then that the hard cap was going to be 100. And then we just kept relaxing that.
Is the hard cap 160 now, or is it like you're still slightly pushing it up? Like, we could fit some more in.
It would be difficult to imagine fitting more in, but I know it's the goal.
Right. We're definitely approaching that. We're limited by the physical space of the brewery, as well as the number of game masters and time slots and things like that. Right now, I feel like this is the most that we could do. If we ever expanded and had more space, maybe we could do something else.
So you had mentioned when we talked previously, like, you have an incredibly high retention rate for the people who have come. So positive word of mouth has helped you grow. How did you get those first 60 people in for the campaigns?
It's hard to say, but, like, I do feel like the first 60 that we had, when it was just me and Dana running the games and doing all the content, they got a slightly different experience in that it was kind of more moment-to-moment tailored. Because while they were still sharing the same document, we would literally check in daily, and people could come across things that other groups had done adventuring in that same area. And that was not a sustainable narrative for extra people. And it's still very much true that, like, the things the groups do make, they matter in the world. You feel the after effects of them, but not as quickly in media res from like a 5 o'clock game to a 10 o'clock game. They wouldn't ever now know immediately that world had just been played in.
Oh yeah. It was the Wild West back then. We used to check in after every game, and things that groups did immediately impacted the next group. One example is we had a ruin in an old forest called the Sunken Cathedral. And it started off with this big snake monster in the waters. And then down in the dungeon level, there's this big clutch of giant snake eggs. And the first group killed the big snake, went down, saw those, decided it was above their pay grade, and left. It was also a very deadly campaign back then. The second group that went in there found the corpse of the snake, went down, and they found a bunch of baby snakes, and they cleared that out. Well, one of the tenets of our world is whenever you completely clear out a dungeon, given time, it will re-dungeonize and more monsters will move in. So then it became the lair of something else and so on and so forth. It's fun to think about. That's very much how the first 6 months were of the campaign. And then we had to come up with something that was more sustainable.
How do you, like, 60 people is a lot. 160 is insane. How do you keep everyone on task and making sure they keep to the time frame to make sure they do everything? There's not like one group left behind because they're fiddling around in a shop and another one's charging ahead.
Right. And I'm sure Law will have some very good things to say. But the way we write our storylines, very much often it is things that are happening in this geographic area, regardless of what the players are doing. Like, things happen. Other NPCs have machinations and plans. But in terms of a single session, as long as the start and end point are the same, there is a lot of wiggle room in between that for what individual parties do.
Is there ever a chance like one party could miss out on doing something because they weren't?
Miss out's one way to say it, but they're doing something else instead. Like, there's always the content happening. It's like, oh, we went north on this road and we met these really weird sellers of potions and also talked to this like ancient entity. It was like, well, we went through the forest and we relived this ancient battle and then met a tavern owner. It turns out it wasn't real. So they can kind of compare notes, and the Discord with the people comparing notes after sessions is robust and intense.
Right. From the very beginning, we planned. We knew that people were going to talk to each other about what they experienced, so we planned for that. It is impossible in the campaign to experience everything, because in any given session, we write enough that for a typical one, even if you're fast, even if you're on task, you're never going to see more than 2/3 of the content. There's always more that other people experience that you haven't seen.
Yeah, and some groups are more interested in role-playing or trying to get out of a fight by being clever or taming, soothing the wild beast kind of thing, whereas others are very interested in the challenge and the mechanics of the fights we build. Especially at, we mentioned the finales, that's one of our big selling points, is because when you come in, you don't always get to play with your same group. We shuffle the tables, so you're playing with layfarers who have done that adventure, but from a totally different perspective, and then working together in a new setting with big, like, 10-table fights that matter what happens at each table.
How much of what you prepare doesn't get experienced by the role players?
Okay, it is very rare. Excuse me. It is very rare for a piece of content to not get experienced at all. But there is one funny story about that from our second chapter. Where they were establishing themselves in a new area. They were trying to ingratiate themselves to the various local factions. And so they collected a quest board of all the requests by various people, and they got to choose which quests they do. And they had time to do like 2 or 3 of them. There was one particular quest that not a single one of these like 18 groups decided to do, and it was to go look for this lost caravan of horses in the marshlands. And what I had written on that is keep track of the number of horses each group recovers, because that will become the total number of horses that exist at the Green Fort and that are available for other things. So 0 horses. So here we are close to year 2. And for the first time, I've been emphasizing, like, there's a horse here. It's the first time you've ever seen one.
It's a post-apocalyptic setting, if that helps to understand why.
Yeah, that's
there,
true.
There are, like, ecosystem changes as to why there's an absence of horses and whatnot.
Right, and also a lot of creatures in various areas have been changed. So in our very first area, plant and animal hybrids were a thing. Later on, all normal animals in another area kind of became monstrosities. So they've seen weird feathered bird horses and things like that, but normal horse in this world?
Yeah, it's like Avatar, the first Airbender role, the last Airbender, where every animal's a fusion.
On the opposite side of that, of someone not doing the task that you made up, have you had to invent something on the fly because they went a different direction you didn't even thought they were going to do?
I mean, it happens in small doses based on the GM, but it's mostly like them, how they might interpret a character. Like, this character, they can develop a little more backstory because there wasn't much written for that particular NPC. So they can kind of vamp it and buff it up a little bit and have a fun interaction. It doesn't really hurt the whole storyline. But we are pretty good at building beginning, middle, end of each chapter. And since there are almost, you know, 30 groups playing, at least one of the GMs will touch everything.
Right, and whenever somebody does kind of go off the rails and color some things in, they usually message the rest of the GMs right away just to say, this is what I did, and some of that can be very fun, too.
And this might be too big of a question for the time we have left, something I accused James of just before we started, but what makes a good dungeon master?
Well, that we've done a lot of interviews, so we ask ourselves that question all the time. We're a quick little fun note, one of our interview processes is we have them run a one-hour game, and you can learn so much about a person's game style by running a one-hour game. It's like an unheard-of length, and it's become kind of one of our favorite formats to play. So organization, obviously, is helpful. Ability to improvise and read the room, and also be very aware of people's gaming needs. We have a lot of focus on storytelling safety tools. So we focus like content warnings first, awareness of people's comfort levels, and then making sure that they feel like they get the spotlight for their scenes and their characters.
Yeah, I guess I would add that there are certain things that we look for professional game masters, but just in the grand scheme of things, anyone can do it. Everyone has their own strengths. I think playing to those strengths is something you learn. And I think the best game masters are the people that can listen, communicate, read the room, like Law was saying, and be able to improvise something that everyone's going to enjoy, because ultimately that's what it's about.
If you can get like 4 or 5 good silly voices too, that's
good. That's good.
Especially if you're running for kids. If you don't know what to do for kids, give them a silly little guy to talk to, and you can eat up like a great hour of time, and it'll be fun.
Well, thanks. Well, before we disappear, I would like to let you two like promote yourself, promote TPK, and anything you got going on to make sure people know about it.
Real quick thing, me and Dana are both on a podcast that me and my friend Zach have run. We're about 7 years old. We're one of the like I don't want to talk about scale. That's not something that I have a good awareness of. Portland podcast, the League of Ultimate Questing. The original setting was that the fantasy world is viewed by an audience, and each team is kind of like a sports team almost, in that the quests are projected and watched. There's advertisements for fake fantasy products. People rise through the ranks and compete against each other. And Dana's been with us since season 2. And yeah, League of Ultimate Questing, fun thing that we do together that's not TPK.
Yeah, and then we should also mention Ales and Scales, mm-hmm. our big Dungeons & Dragons event for Geek Week, which of course for us kicks off with Rose City Comic Con. But then we are doing a 2-week event?
Yeah, it's a several sessions worth of the newest book published by Wizards, which is The Dragon Delves, which is an anthology of dragon-themed adventures for the 2024 setting. And we're running all of them. You earn coins as you play through, and at the end we're having like a night market where you can spend those coins to get extra rewards like miniatures, the book itself, special posters, and have a big finale game. And the reason we mention that is there are still a few slots left, and they sold fast.
Right. And so if that sounds like something you're interested in doing, some of the physical prizes are very fun and the community is even better. So, yeah, think about coming and joining us for that.
Yeah. If you go to tpkbrewing.com, you can see our calendar. It's a very robust gaming calendar. It has all of our events, side quests, info on the layfairs like we talked about earlier, and the big event coming up.
Great. Thank you so much, and thank you so much for being here. Thank you, everyone, for listening to Winner's Bias. If you would like to comment on the show, have any questions, or suggest discussion topics, you can email us at winnersbias@kbu.org, and you can find us on Instagram at winnersbias. I'm Nate.
And I'm James. We want to remind you that KBU is a volunteer-powered community platform. That means we are funded by you, the listener. Just go to kbu.fm/give, or text KBOO to 44321. And remember, it's not about the games you play, but how you get everyone to stop trying to split up the party.
You're tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.